I strongly suspect that we, and I include myself in this, come to worship with blended purpose. God's glory, and let's call it our enjoyment. For myself, I come to worship God, and I expect to enjoy it positively, be blessed in some way. Well, that's how it is for me. About 18 years ago, a church that I knew in Watford, England, a church named Soul Survivor. Has anyone come across it? It's a much used title. Various people run with it. They're a church that produces outstanding musicians, Matt Redman, Tim Hughes, to name a few, been a tremendous influence globally in terms of youth, discipleship, evangelism. They have a very discerning pastor, a guy called Mike Pilavachi. And about 18 years ago, he realized something. He realized that on Sunday afternoon, what people were doing was critiquing the worship, especially the musicians. It was a bit this, or that song, it was a bit that, and so on. And he realized something. This is not ideal. And he took a bold step, and he said, for 3 months, no music. This is a youth church. A youth church, no music. So there would be lots of silence, stillness, and waiting. And I've been there, and it's a church without pews. So that meant sitting on the floor, lots of group time, while hearts learned to focus on the Lord of the music instead of the music of the Lord. This could be a sermon on idolatry or something like that. And out of that process, Matt Redman wrote a song. It's a song we sing sometimes. Got the words here. When the music fades, all is stripped away, and I simply come, longing just to bring something that's of worth, that'll bless your heart. That's talking to the Lord. I'll bring you more than a song, for a song in itself is not what you have required. You search much deeper within through the way things appear. You're looking into my heart. And then the response, I'm coming back to the heart of worship. And it's all about you. All about you, Jesus. I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it. When it's all about you, Jesus. And there's another verse. I so respect that process. I so respect what happened and admire that song that came out of it. I think it connects with that question I ask, worship. Is it for God? Is it for us? How discerning are we of that reality, of the blend, and which way is it trending? So their music fast was to shift focus from worship music and possibly the worship of music to rightful, full-hearted devotion to the Lord. It's about Jesus. We, and especially those who prepare worship, and I spend a lot of my time preparing occasions of worship. You do, and the team who aren't here, others as well who read, we need to be constantly in a process of discerning and refining at this level. Is it for God or is it for us? One of the questions that sometimes is asked in churches, and it used to be asked here, and I don't hear it in recent years, but is afterwards saying, well, how did we do? How did we do? How on earth do you answer that question? If worship is unto the Lord. Okay. So this business of worship for God and our own, as it were, investment in it. Investment in the sense that you give seeking a return. It's about horse and cart. It's one of my favorite pictures, this, by the way. I love the look on the horse. It captures how things can get out of order so often and so easily. I put it up partly because we're going to have a passage now that involves a cart. So that's just a little link there. So we're going to today's text, which was the first reading we heard today, which has so much to say about worship, and there's more coming next week. It includes an ox and a cart. And where, if you've got Bibles in some form, digital or cellulose, it's 2 Samuel chapter 6, the whole chapter. Guido brought it to us this morning. So we need some background here before we get into the story. David had just become king. Hooray! The second king of Israel after Saul. And on his own initiative, he had captured the city Jerusalem. This is a poignant thing today still. This is when Jerusalem came into Jewish hands, when David took it. And it became known as the City of David. He took it from the Jebusites, people who were there beforehand. David was very clearly about nation building. So the way Israel had been constituted until then was the 12 tribes. And they were a league of these 12 tribes. They're a tribal society, if you've lived among tribal people. And David was shifting them from that to being a nation with a king, and here it comes, a royal capital. Jerusalem wasn't just real estate. It was going to be the royal capital of the nation, the kingdom that he was building. Now, for all this to really happen well, worship needed to change. It needed to change. You might think that's strange by today's way of thinking, but the center of the nation had to be also the place where God could be found. It had to be the place where God's name was pleased to dwell, as would be later referred to. And up until then, the center of God's presence among these 12 tribes had been the Ark of the Covenant. So we're going to talk a lot about the Ark of the Covenant today, and a picture will come shortly. So where this gold box that contains the terms of the covenant, the Ten Commandments, where that was, and a few other bits and pieces, where that was deemed to be the footstool of God's throne. So God is enormous, but on earth he has this footstool where his feet touch base, as it were. And this was moved around. Now, you can anticipate. We have a mindset here of politics and religion, of church and state, of worship and nation building being connected. David wants that focus for the worship of God, that focus for the presence of God in his city. So that God is worshipped in his royal capital. And the legacy of this sort of thinking is not uncommon. You go around the world, and how many places do you see a capital city, the seat of government and power, and just not far away is a major place of worship? I don't think you have that in the Netherlands, but in many other places, it's there. And there's an interaction often between them. But in David's time, this economy is full on. This is what is happening. So today we heard about part of this process, part of David's nation-building process, relocating the Ark of the Covenant to his new capital city. Now, he knows, David, that relocating the Ark of the Covenant is a big thing. You touch the Ark of the Covenant in any way, and someone did later on in the story, that's massive. It's the footstool of God's throne. Now, David has been a worshiper since he was knee-high. When he was out with the sheep, you have a lot of time on your hands with the sheep, he worshipped, he praised, he wrote psalms. We still sing them and pray them today. But as he begins his reign as king around the age of 30, it becomes apparent there's a lot he doesn't know. His heart's in the right place, but there's a lot he doesn't know. So he sets off for this national event. The day the Ark of the Covenant went from one of the shrines among the tribes and arrived in the city of David to stay. It would never move from there again. And he involves thousands of people, and there's lots of music. And we read songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. All this seemed to be a really good idea. You need a big band if you're going to shift the Ark of the Covenant. It sounds like what a lot of people would expect in church. What do you need in church? Lots of people and music. And it's tragic. But it's another sermon. Seriously. A number of times I've heard in this part of the country, well, we couldn't have a service because there was no choir. Hello. That's quite deep. So, lots of people and music. And then you can have action. But there was a big problem. And the problem was David had not bothered to do his homework. He had not consulted. He had not researched. Is there a right way to shift the Ark of the Covenant? Had God actually specified something about where his footstool or how it was to be handled? The specification in the law, the Torah, there was a specification, was that it should be carried on the shoulders of priests bearing those acacia poles. That is the way God wanted his footstool moved around. What had David done? He'd gone high tech. You got a brand new ox cart, got some oxen. Fantastic. He thought. Hadn't done his homework, hadn't considered how does God want to be honored? God just might have a view on this. God actually may be the Lord of the covenant who said, thou shalt not, might be very insistent about this detail. So this became an issue when the ox or oxen stumbled. And someone named Uzzah thought it would be a good idea, again, someone who hadn't done his homework, to stabilize the ark because it just might fall off. And he reached out to prevent it falling, and we read it was the last thing he ever did. Holiness broke out. And we read, David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. This was supposed to be David's big day. This was supposed to be a day that would be celebrated forever. The Ark of the Covenant coming to his city. Supposed to be a moment of splendid worship. Instead, God's manifest action there led to a loss of life. God had broken out of his box, and it was not sweet. Holy power brought death. Now, to step into this, I found myself thinking, how would I feel if someone died because I didn't prepare worship properly? I got it wrong on a Sunday morning, and sorry, it was someone in the back row didn't walk out. That's where David was. Imagine the mixture of feelings and confusion, and it says anger. Didn't say he was angry with. He's probably angry with himself. So, why had this gone so wrong? It had gone wrong because David had forgotten or not realized, just like Adam and the apple. Duh. Hadn't thought it through. Hadn't done his homework. It had gone wrong because he hadn't realized or had forgotten that Yahweh is a holy God to be taken seriously. There are plenty of other gods in the nations around who will conform, or you can prescribe what happens because they're just wind-up toys. But this is the great I am. You don't mess around with the great I am. You take him seriously. It's what the Old Testament refers to as the fear of the Lord. Serious consideration. Worship of the Lord is not like a walk in the park or a party with sacred music. I get to see lots of churches on YouTube, and it's interesting. The spectrum between a concert and worship. It's that same question I ask. Is it here for the Lord or is it here for us? It's all there, together with smoke machines and light shows and other things that you really need for worship. David had presumed on God and learned a costly lesson. So, you can see this. You can see the implication of those who want to seriously worship the Lord. It means that God seeks and requires, what God seeks and requires really needs to be sought and taken seriously. It needs to be focused on what the Lord seeks and not on what we want or according to our agendas or our ideas of what is practical or expedient. Unless we do this, holiness may break out in ways that hurt. But hang on a minute, Francis. Isn't that terribly Old Testament? Isn't that sort of wrath and judgment? Just remember what Paul said to the Corinthians about how they ministered and shared Holy Communion. This is 1 Corinthians 11:29. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on themselves. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. If you don't approach or handle the holy appropriately, something can break out. That's the theology here. And it's Paul is seeing this active in the Corinthians, who were massively into worship. They were exuberant. I always think of them as Californians. Sorry to any Californians here. But they were had that sort of Las Vegas kind of culture. That's Nevada, I know. But just staying on the West Coast. they were massively into worship. We could really develop this. In the Old Testament, the times of Amos and Isaiah, hugely into worship. Worship was big, big, big. But if you go into it wrongly, something in there can break out. And the lesson is costly. So, consequently, back to the story, David was afraid of the Lord that day. He did not sleep well that night. And he said, he asked the right question, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? I've been light about this. I've got my city. But how can I bring that into my city? So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David. He was realizing that handling the holy is serious business. Worship is nothing casual. Now, a bit of light relief here. If you're British, you'll get this. At this point, David needed a git. A git. He needed a git to take care of this terrible ark. What is a git? You could tell us, please. A git? It's a silly person. Yeah. A person who's unpleasant, silly, incompetent, annoying, not up to grade. We read, so David took it aside, this is the ark, to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. David needed a soft number. Gosh, where can I park this thing? It's too hot to handle. This guy. Or put it in his place. The blessing of the ark, however, fell on, or the presence of the Lord, rather, fell on that house. And 3 months later, David, who'd been watching safety from a distance, saw that Obed-Edom's house had flourished, had prospered. Good things had happened. And so he took courage. So David set out again to bring the ark to Jerusalem, to his city. Now this time, it's on poles, carried by priests. He's read the law. He's taken advice. And he dressed himself in an ephod. Now, an ephod is a linen garment. And the question is, how big was his ephod? That's the Slim Jim model. Minimalist. It could have been bigger. But one of the things I was reminded of just a few weeks ago, Daniel, it was in our last Vorhangers Overleg, got to speak to a Palestinian or an Arab Christian. He's doing evangelism here. And he just mentioned in passing, in the Arab culture, the shame of a man is from the knees up. So if you reveal anything above the knees, it's for a man, it's shameful. So you don't wear hot pants in the Middle East. For a woman, it's everywhere, tip to toe. So anything from the knee up in those cultures is disrespectful, is shameful. David has his ephod. But whatever it was a sort of garment that with vigorous action may have been revealing. How much it revealed, I don't know. We also read that this time the musical instruments were different. There was a horn, probably a shofar, which is a ram's horn, and there was shouting. Human voices, horns. No castanets or lyres or of the other instruments mentioned before, or cymbals. And there is full-on dancing. Now, I'd like to think David is age 30. He still has his moves. And he's going to dance vigorously. So it's now linen clothing, horns blowing, shouting, and full-on dancing. And every 6 paces, an animal sacrifice. Yes, so a sheep or a bull, every 6 paces. David has learned his lesson to worship the Lord as the Lord prescribes. Now, this is now worship in the fear of the Lord. And it's about to be tested. Never think that godly worship pleases everyone. And my experience, 25 years of being a pastor, is that sometimes there is godly worship in a church and someone will complain. It comes with the patch. So as this procession enters Jerusalem, his first wife sees it and she is not amused. Michal was Saul's daughter and she grew up a princess. Their marriage had begun in love, but it had been damaged when father-in-law, or Michal's father, Saul, got so annoyed with David, he took Michal away and gave her to someone else. It's a tragic story. Should never, ever happen. And he gave her to a man who also loved her. And David, when he became king, he took her back. Political significance here, continuity, you know. So this is the background to the relationship. So she was raised to present herself as royalty. If you were a youth group, it would take 30 seconds now to just assume a royal pose. Something like that. That was her upbringing. Serious royals don't do wild dancing. Don't do wild dancing. Even the sort of relaxed royals of Northwest Europe, Denmark and the Netherlands and Belgium, they don't do wild dancing, do they? No, it's still a step too far. Not even for God. Serious royals don't get sweaty and they don't get excited in worship. Real royals stay cool, impassionate, somewhat aloof. Okay. David had been a shepherd boy, a musician, a warrior. He'd been to hell and back in the previous 17 years. He was no mouse. And on that day, he wanted to worship the Lord. He'd learned his lesson. He'd done his homework. He prepared himself. He was going to go for it. With all his might, we read. Now, this might have begun as a political operation. Get that ark into my city. But somewhere in the process, he'd been refined. This had become worship. And it was going to be the worship moment of his life. And so we read in verse 16, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. And then to end the day, while that is happening, David made the final sacrificial offerings to the Lord. The ark is now in his city. It's been put in under a canopy, a temporary place, because there was no temple or shrine there. And he blesses the people. And he sends them home with bread and meat and raisin cakes. True worship does not forget the poor. And then he went home, and words were said to Michal and her despising heart. Michal said what she thought, and David says, it was before the Lord. Honey, I wasn't dancing for you. It was before the Lord, who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me to rule over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will be even more undignified than this. And I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But these slave girls you spoke of, by them I will be held in honor. Anticipating Paul saying, I will be a fool for the Lord. Even in worship. You hear the strength of focus and determination. What started 3 months before, half-baked, has come to a hard, clear focus. That's quite a slap down for Michal, isn't it? And so the second takeaway I want to offer for today comes out of that phrase that David offers. I will be even more undignified than this. And I will be humiliated even in my own eyes, because I will worship the Lord with all my might. Whatever you think. I think this was David at his finest. You know, the Goliath incident, it's great for Sunday school. But this to me is, he's focused. He loses focus subsequently, doesn't he? But at this point, a bit of holy terror, true meaning of the word awe, an awesome experience of God, had wised him up and refined him. Our commitment to worship, if we even have half of what David had there, can lead to things that some people might find undignified. It happens. Even in the purely personal, if you are 100% you, someone will have a problem with that. Don't we live with that all the time? If you are 100% you before the Lord in worship, someone will have a problem with that. It stopped a long time ago, but Monday, the phone used to ring. And I used to have digital recognition on my phone. So about 9 o'clock, okay, here come the numbers. Something happened on Sunday that someone had objection to, and I got to hear about it on Monday morning. That's church. That's sort of happens in a lot of churches. It doesn't happen here anymore, happily. I don't have digital recognition anymore either. But here's my word on this. So long as worship is genuine and what God seeks, it's not undignified. Tears offered in worship are precious. You know, someone in tears in a church can be disturbing to others, can seem undignified, but I suggest not to God. Arms raised and hands clapping are encouraged in the Psalms, even if that's sort of a bit exuberant. You're a bit excited this morning, weren't you? Vigorous dancing with sweaty bodies. I'm looking at my African friends here. It must be hot in Africa when you dance. Do you get sweaty? Ben? Be honest. You do. Okay. All these people in cooler climes who've lost touch of sweat. Vigorous dancing with sweat offered in pure worship is not undignified. Horn blowing and shouting offered for God's glory is not undignified. The list could go on, couldn't it? Authenticity and as God requires. And Jesus said what the Lord requires when he spoke to that woman in John chapter 4, the woman at the well, the Father seeks those who worship him in spirit and in truth. Nothing about their dress code. Now, this does not mean, some people pick this up but a wrong way and think, okay, so worship is about sweat and vigorous dancing, lots of noise and tears. So every week at 10:30, it's all on. And there are some churches who take that approach. That does not mean one should set out to offer tears, blow horns, dance vigorously, or shout, but they are not to be despised. And if the Lord breaks out in people in those ways, it is not to be despised. Paul, writing to the Corinthians, who were sort of on this wavelength, do all things. Can anyone finish the phrase? Decently and in good order. But do it. Yeah, to the glory of God. That's where he was going with this. So, I'll continue with this next week, but for now, just the two takeaways. When worshiping the Lord, have it in mind. Apply your mind to this. I want to worship the Lord. What has the Lord made known that he seeks in my worship? Start from that end rather than, well, I'd like to do this and this and this and so-and-so would like that and the kids would like this and could get it terribly wrong. Start with that thinking, what is it that the Lord requires? Secondly, what people consider undignified may be precious to God. And there's discernment required here. There's real discernment, especially in a multicultural church like us, because we have very different ideas as to what's dignified and what's not dignified. And we need to be clear on whose values of dignity and worth we are tuned to. Is it the fear of the Lord? And that fear is not a neurotic, teeth-rattling sort of fear. It is a serious respect, a serious consideration, a healthy fear. Or is it fear of people? If I do this, so-and-so might think such and such. One of the things that sometimes worship leaders, in particular people who stand in front of a congregation, need to do is tune out from the congregation. And in my early days, I did it by imagining a spot on the back wall. The spot wasn't God, but it helped me have my thoughts away from all the messages and the responses and the signals one might get from a congregation. If you're doing a concert, it's the other way around, isn't it? Here's your paying public. You build a rapport. You orientate to them. But in worship, we need to be mindful of each other or aware of the people around us, but focused on the Lord. The fear of the Lord takes us there. Good stuff to talk about over coffee. You know, you can say, what Francis said today, that spoke to me, or I don't buy that at all. I think he's got it, he's terribly wrong there. But talk about these things. We're going to have an opportunity now to step into worship together. We're going to do it via a prayer. It's the prayer set in this liturgy, which in preparation to come to the table, there's a prayer of confession. And it says, come, let us return to the Lord. Return is the big call upon people of faith again and again. We wander, we drift. So this is an opportunity to, well, consider maybe how we have failed or fallen short in worship. And you do this, you first consider how you have fallen short before you step up to the mark again. It's like the 3 months that David took to reconsider how do you worship with the Ark of the Covenant. And then Kate and the team are ready to lead us into a song. And I hope this is a moment of worship, a moment where you can be focused on the Lord. It's a song with only 4 words, apparently, so you might not need to scream. So that's where we're going. So just take a moment of silence, first of all. What has been raised for you in terms of worship and your worship life? The things we've spoken about. Come, let us return to the Lord and say, Lord, in our God, in our sin we have avoided your call. Our love for you is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes away early. Have mercy on us, pardon us from our judgment, pardon up our wounds, and revive us in Jesus Christ our Lord.